This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. Up first, we'll explore how art can be an effective way to heal from stress and trauma. We're joined now by Yabi Tab. Yabi is an artist and the creative placemaking fellow at the Harrison Center in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for joining us, Yabi. We really appreciate having you here today. I want to start off by asking you a little bit about your life as an artist. How long have you been an artist?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I have been an artist my whole life, but I've been professionally an artist just for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So, and what got you into art?
Well, I always loved to draw and paint and do literally anything I can to visually express myself since I was little. But then when I went to school at Indiana Wesleyan University, I was introduced to a major called Design for Social Impact. And it was merging visual arts and design and problem solving to like social problems, and which was something that really interested me. So, yes, mm-hmm. That's how I got into it.
That's interesting. So using art to deal with social problems, we're kind of talking about something similar. So why is art, do you think, in your opinion, an effective way of healing or coping with stress or even, as you mentioned, social issues?
Yeah, for me, I think art allows me to question things that are happening around me, meaning that it helps me spend more time with the issue that I am either trying to solve or trying to process for myself. So usually whatever I do, I start with the question, why is this a problem and why and how can I solve it? So visually, just the tactile way of painting or drawing or printmaking is a way of just expressing all of those thoughts into a form that is releasing what I'm feeling inside.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about the research you did during the pandemic?
Yes. Yeah, so my thesis research was for my senior research, and it was about creating safe spaces for Black women working or attending at predominantly white institutions. And the reason I chose that topic it was at a very difficult time in America. That was around last summer, as you know, a lot of the protests were happening, and I wanted to create a space where Black women can authentically process these things. So it was a combination of interviews and visually illustrating those conversations through printmaking. So I was able to create a gallery show, just a solo show that was held during Black History Month, and people were able to enter into a conversation as they listen to the audio recording of these women sharing about their experiences.
Mm-hmm. And when you went into this project, did you have some ideas that were challenged when you put it all together, or did it align with what you already thought?
It really did align with what I was already thinking, but I was really amazed and also pleased by how that space was safe for all of us as we were sharing things that we all experience. Mm-hmm. And like you said earlier, using art as a way of processing. So it really gave us a place to let out all of those things that, you know, it's not just about frustration and anger, but also like things that make us happy, things that mm-hmm. we love to do and talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what else did you find during this research? Was there anything surprising?
I think I learned a lot about myself through the process of how to share my work or observation with others boldly, even if it feels scary and intimidating. So the solo show at my school wasn't really required for me to do. There's a senior exhibit for everybody at the end of the year, but solo show is something that really I was just drawn to doing mm-hmm. just because of the time and how that space I felt was really necessary. So I learned to just sort of step into spaces that seem scary or that seem intimidating.
Right, right. I mean, I guess art sometimes requires you to be bold. And did you feel that after this project, now you can do more things? Like, did this kind of sort of pave the way for you?
Yes, definitely. Knowing what I know now and like how to carry on conversations, when I did that research, I've never done an art form with audio recordings before. So mm-hmm. it was really interesting to see how hearing someone else's voice as an art form really opens up the experience to a whole different level. So when you hear that someone is going through an experience, then you can also relate to it. That mm-hmm. means that you're also creating that safe space and healing for your own self when you see that you're not going through this alone. So it really like allowed me to experiment with areas that I have not tried before.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think it also, it shows just, you know, how important representation is, and to see yourselves in things that are being produced, even in the artistic realm. Do you feel mm-hmm. like the art that you create, you mentioned sort of like hearing other people's stories help. Do you feel like sometimes you're doing it for yourself as much as you're also doing it for the audience?
Yes, absolutely. I think just to relate to like what's been happening, you know, with the pandemic and everything, art really had allowed me to sort of slow down and spend time with my own thoughts and things that I'm processing. So when I think about visual arts, and I do printmaking, which means I, you know, carve on wood or metal and things like that, the actual tactile way of telling stories through visual art really allows me to spend time with the story that I'm trying to tell, as well as just, you know, let out things, emotions that have been inside of me. Even if it doesn't feel like I'm processing things, but it's such a very meditative practice that at the end I leave feeling a little lighter than I went before I started.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you got to like kind of get in the zone and really focus on your work. I'm just curious for myself, like, is it hard if you're like really focused and then somebody comes and interrupts you? How are you able to do that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's like some aspect of it is like not really individual. So like when I don't mind being interrupted, like some of the more methodical works that I do, like it's nice to have people and noise in the background. But you're right. Sometimes when I'm like in the zone, especially when I like write and things like that, it's really hard to get back in the groove after you've been interrupted. But usually I like seeing people and noise around me.
Yeah. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, or if you've been involved with arts programming and want to share your experience, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. So Gabby, like what was conducting this research like? I know we've kind of talked a little bit about it, but could you take us through how you put together the project, and then how maybe for our audience to visualize like what it looked like when it came together?
Yeah, so at first was sparked by the whole idea of having a space to process hard things, and particularly for Black women. So when I started the research, I read a lot of literature that was written by Black women to sort of understand a lot of the stereotypes, negative stereotypes that shape our experiences and how we navigate those spaces. So the things that I explored are the strong Black women narratives and the angry Black women, all of these things that really hinder our experience from to truly like step into our full self and belong into spaces. Mm-hmm. And after doing the, you know, literature review and all of these like actual, you know, research, the data that I collected was more of just stories. So like I interviewed several Black women at the school that I attended, both professors and students at that time, of like, how are we dealing with this such complicated and heavy thing? And how are our peers around us who are not Black students being an ally, or like sort of giving us a space to process that, which there was such a lack of space to do that in mm-hmm. institutions. So that's how it started. But then as I collected the stories, I was able to allow the whole student body to enter into those conversations as I played excerpts from the interviews into a speaker in the gallery accompanied with visual arts. So people were invited to step into that. And if they were interested into listening to the full conversation, they scanned a QR code that led them to the actual episode of the podcast. And for me, it was one, seeing ourselves represented in the art, in the area of art and higher education, especially where we don't see literature by Black authors as much, especially if you're attending, you know, a predominantly white institution. So for me, it was, you know, tackling all of those conversations about representation, things that make us angry and frustrated, as well as the joyful experience that we have as people. So it was like a merge of like just our experience and allowing other people to enter into that.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really cool. And I wonder, though, if it was like also an ability for the general population to come in and sort of put themselves in the shoes of these stories and be immersed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think after the show, a lot of Black people were really impacted by the fact that they also related to those stories, that was also their experience. Mm-hmm. And non-Black students and professors were also allowed to enter into that, like, oh, okay, this is how it is, and also sort of introspect and how they can be a part of creating that safe space for everyone that's around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful. We have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about how people can use art to create a sense of community.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Art, I think, again, art is allowing us to see and to reflect about our experiences broadly, either personal experiences or communal experiences. So I think for me, I work at the Harrison Center. I'm a creative placemaking fellow. And the way I am creating community here is by working with community members to teach different art classes and things like that. So art doesn't have to be one thing. It doesn't have to be painting or drawing or illustration. It can be anything. It can be music. It can be, you know, poetry. But it can truly bring people together because we have such a shared experience. And through art, we can all tell our own stories.
I love that. Through art, we can all tell our own stories. Well, thank you so much, Yabi, for your time. Yabi Tab. Yabi is an artist and a creative placemaking fellow at the Harrison Center in Indianapolis. Coming up after the break, we'll continue our Friday recap where we revisit a few of the conversations we had over the last week. And we'll hear from an author of a new book that profiles three generations of women in the American Midwest. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we'll hear from the author of a new book that profiles three generations of women in the American West. We begin the conversation with Lisa Hendrickson with a look back on the challenges these women faced moving from Missouri to Montana.
It was a year-long journey. It was very difficult. These women joined a wagon train of about 500 people that started in Kansas and headed out. They spent the winter in a place in Colorado called Empire City, and they ended up an entire year later in Virginia City, Montana Territory, which was where they had intended to end their journey. Along the way, they had to obviously take huge stores of food. They had to find their own, they had to find water in places where the water was often not potable. So they had to make sure that they carried enough water with them. Lizzie Knave Martin and her daughter had their own wagon that they covered with two layers of canvas on the top. And they even brought along a milk cow along with their oxen. One of the interesting stories I found when Lulu Martin wrote she presented to many years later to a group of women about her experiences on the wagon train. And she talked about how her mother put milk in a churn in the wagon. And as the wagon moved and traveled over the rutted roads, it actually churned the butter magically by itself. And so they ended up with what she called a most palatable spread. But they also had to deal with, there was a real concern about being trampled by herds of bison. And there were times along the way when they saw dust roiling up along the prairie. They didn't know what it was. They lived in fear of Indian attacks, which actually weren't as didn't occur as often as the newspapers of the time liked to talk about. But the bison, being trampled by bison was actually, I discovered, it was a real fear. And so when that happened, the travelers had to put their wagons in a circle, and all the people got in the center of where the wagons were. And as the hundreds or thousands of bison went by, fortunately, these wagons were spared. And afterwards, the men shot the bison, and everybody in the wagon train cut it up and actually used it as food. And Lizzie and Luli put it between the canvases in their covered wagon, and so it dried and made jerky as they traveled along. So when you hear about the ingenious ways that people had to survive as they traveled along, they also had to worry about storms out on the prairie. And in my book, there was disease, there were terrible accidents, and all along the way, these travelers found graves of people marked with wooden crosses, these tragedies even touched the Ney family as well, which I go into detail about in the book.
This is giving me some flashbacks of Oregon Trail that I played as yes. a kid, where yeah. you know, you learned about on the trail, all these things can happen. And a year is a long time to dedicate to something like that. Was there any indication why they didn't just stop somewhere halfway and just be like, this is where we're going to settle down, that's it? Or did they know they wanted to go to Montana?
Although I didn't find great detail about that, I believe that they were actually heading towards Virginia City, because Virginia City at the time was gold had just been discovered there. And I think the family thought that they could make a living in this new spot. But it is interesting. And they did overwinter in Empire City. And along the way, some members of the Ney family actually left and went back to Missouri because a family member, they had learned that a family member had become ill or died. So they didn't even all arrive in Virginia City at the same time. And as they traveled along, the wagon train became smaller and smaller. So many people, I think, did decide not to continue on, but the Ney family did. And when they got to Virginia City, it was a boom town, a small boom town. But then they had to spend a winter, a very difficult winter, because the snow was so high that it was difficult for the food to get to Virginia City. And there was there wasn't enough flour, and the Ney family had to sew bags of flour into their mattresses so it wouldn't be stolen, and hide it in the beams of the ceiling of their cabin. So they spent a very difficult winter there as well.
Wow. And to think that we think we have it hard these days.
Absolutely. We don't know.
You know, one thing I was curious about, you mentioned earlier, fear of attacks maybe from Native Americans. Is there mention of Native Americans at all in any of the documentation you found during this period of time?
Yes, it's interesting, but much of what I found was actually, you know, much like what you might find today in reading various things, there was a lot of fear and speculation about Indian attack. But according to the historians that I read, it really wasn't as much of a threat as most people believed. The real threats were disease. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was violence among Native Americans and the people moving west, because obviously the Native Americans' land was being threatened. And so they were defending their right to their land. But it wasn't from the research that I did that wasn't the real threat. The real threat were things like disease and drowning and storms. But that wasn't what people talked about as much.
Yeah, it sounds like they had their own sort of version of misinformation going around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you read newspaper articles of the time, it's really quite stunning. The prejudice and the racism that was just, it was prevalent in newspapers at the time.
When you started working on this project, I'm always curious to learn just about like how things come together and how you find the material. Was it difficult to put this together, you know, to research stuff from the past and find stuff, or were you able to find relevant things?
You know, this book took me almost 10 years to write. I had no idea that it would take me so long. But I call it going down the rabbit hole. I just love doing the research. And I really wanted this book to give readers a sense of what it was like to live in that time and to put them in the scene. So when I was writing, I wanted to make sure that I had a lot of detail, and what details I couldn't find from the family, because there were some written records and letters from the family. I also did a lot of research in old newspapers and books. The interesting thing about my research is that I don't think I could have written a book like this 10 years ago, because during that time, most newspapers came online. And so I was able to search by people's names back all the way back to the 1840s and 50s and 60s and find a lot of detail. Another thing that was astounding to me was the helpfulness of people who worked in courts and courthouses and historical societies. For example, in my book, Lizzie Martin, when her husband dies, he left a will, and I happened to find the wording of his will online, believe it or not. And then I went on a search and actually called the courthouse in Missouri to try to find a copy of the will. And lo and behold, a person who worked there came across an entire file of Lizzie's debts and bills from the 1860s and how much she owed and how much she paid back. So when I talk in the book about how she went to a general store on a certain date and bought a number of yards of fabric, that is actually true information that came from these records. So I was astounded to find just all kinds of detail that I didn't know existed. And that's the fun part for me. The writing is hard. The research is fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so interesting. I'm just thinking now, like, I would love to just dig through old records from, you know, 100 or so years ago and just see what people were up to. I mean, I guess it also helps put things in perspective. But when you were talking earlier, you mentioned about paying off the debts that women had to do. And when Lizzie's husband died, she was not only caring for her child, she also had to pay off her husband's debts. What impact did that have on Lizzie?
Well, it was a huge impact. And one of the things, it took her 8 years to pay off those debts. And one of the things that I found interesting is that those debts were incurred in Missouri. And then she goes out to the Montana Territory. And you think about the fact that it may have been even difficult for those debtors to find her, but she was compelled, she felt compelled to pay back those debts. And so she did that by, she knew how to sew. She was a seamstress. One of the interesting things that I found was that she had the legal right to keep any of her personal property up to $200, meaning clothes, cooking implements, et cetera, et cetera. But she was required to pay back all of her husband's debts, including property that he had purchased before they were married. And I found a quote from one historian that I thought was very compelling. And he wrote that at the time, for many women, a husband's death brought his creditors down on the estate like vultures. And so their debts totaled $1,000 back then, and that equates to about $16,000 today. And it took her about 8 years to earn enough money to repay those, but she finally did.
Is it common, or was, I mean, was it common at that time for widows to take on their late husband's debts?
In Missouri, it was required by law. And then Julia Bennett, you know, years later, when she tried to start her ranch, women weren't even allowed to have their own checking accounts at that time. So when she had to borrow money, she had to borrow it from friends and family, local businessmen, and do handshake deals, which didn't always work out for her. So that's another area in which women we don't think about too much or are aware of. Just gaining access to money as a single woman was very difficult.
Was it hard for her to even get folks, you know, it sounds like she was going around trying to get some money, but were there any instances where because she was a woman, they were just like, no, I'm not going to lend you anything?
Well, Julia Bennett was quite a charming woman. I wish I had met her, but she was a master at getting publicity about her ranch in New York City. She had huge newspaper articles written about her. Her ranch was mentioned in the New Yorker magazine. And she went out there knowing no one. And the way that she managed to fund her ranch was to find these wealthy dudes, as they were called, Eastern dudes. She couldn't have survived without the help of men who lent her money. She had a dear friend who was a rancher who lent her money. She had even clients who visited the ranch who lent her money. So the fact of the matter is that she did require help from a lot of people. One thing we haven't talked about yet is that Julia, she started her dude ranch in Montana in 1931, but realizing that she couldn't make a go of it in the winter months with a Montana dude ranch, she started another ranch in Arizona for the winter months in Tucson in 1936. And that ranch was a property owned by the Westinghouse family, George Westinghouse, the inventor of fame. Their family owned a lot of properties, and they had actually come to stay at the Diamond J Ranch in Montana, and that's how Julia got to know them. She convinced George Westinghouse Jr. to lease her their ranch in Arizona, and that's how she got that business started.
That's really cool, actually, just thinking about all the different things she's doing.
Yeah, she actually, I love this story, she actually convinced George Westinghouse Jr. to lease her the ranch, but she actually didn't have money to pay the rent, but she became good friends with Mr. Westinghouse's wife, Violet. And so Violet Westinghouse and her kids came to stay and paid the bill. And that's how she paid back Mr. Westinghouse. So the women kind of collaborated on that project.
What was it that, I know we kind of touched on this, but I'm just curious, like, what was it that drove Julia to this kind of a business model? Was it that she saw this as a really sustainable way to live?
Well, I think so. I think going back to her own mother, her mother growing up on the ranch out in the middle of nowhere in the Montana Territory, people would frequently, who were traveling from place to place, stop at people's homes to spend the night. That was just kind of an expected way of, there were no hotels, obviously, in those places. So travelers would stop at ranches, and the ranches would give them a place to sleep and eat. So Julia grew up seeing her mother entertain people and take care of people this way. And she, Julia herself, had actually cooked on a couple of ranches for that were owned by a couple of wealthy Chicago brothers. So she understood this life. But she had also tried other professions. Once she separated from her husband, she had tried to be a stenographer at the Montana State Legislature, and she said she wasn't very good at it. She had actually gotten a job as a Fuller Brush salesperson at a time when they were advertising for men. They weren't even advertising for women to do that job. And she said they gave her the territory of Yellowstone National Park, which you can imagine there probably weren't too many people around there to buy brushes at the time. And she said, I couldn't make my salt at that. So I think she felt like she had no choice but to try this. She knew that she knew how to cook. She knew how to entertain people and take care of people. And I think she saw this as her salvation. And she loved doing it. She was a very optimistic person. She never got down, according to her granddaughter. So she saw this as an opportunity.
I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soab, and it's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. For our final segment, we'll catch up on the latest news around the pandemic and the Omicron variant's impact on Indiana so far with three health experts. Shandy Dearth, director of the Center for Public Health Practice at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. Tom Dzinski, director of epidemiology education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at Indiana University. And Graham McKean, assistant university director of public and environmental health at Indiana University. Before the break, we were touching upon the possibility of a fourth booster, but I want to go back a little bit and ask you, Shandy, how good is the booster right now? So you get the two shots and then you get a third dose as a booster.
It's really made a difference. So what we're seeing is that the people coming into the hospitals are not those who have been boosted. And so we're seeing more of the vaccinated people coming to the hospital. We don't really see as many deaths among the fully vaccinated, but the booster really helps keep people out of the hospital. So as Tom said, the booster, you will still be in contact with COVID. At this point, community transmission is so high. So we're seeing lots of people get COVID who have been vaccinated and possibly boosted, but they're not getting so sick that they end up in the hospital, and they're definitely not in the mortality group. So it does make a huge difference, and that's why it looks like that booster will probably become a part of a permanent series. And with that, I can say FDA just yesterday approved a booster for the 12 to 17-year-olds. CDC's ACIP group, that's the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, they meet tomorrow. They are expected to approve that booster for that age group, which is great. That means those middle school and high school kids can get boosted as they're all back in classrooms. And then also CDC effective immediately has cut down the timeline for that booster to 5 months and not six for the booster after that second dose of your vaccine. So if you haven't been boosted yet, I really, really encourage you to go ahead and make that appointment at your local retailer, local health department. Go ahead and get that booster because it makes a difference in what we're seeing with the patients.
Does it change the effectiveness if you wait too long to get a booster? Let's say you waited like 9 months after your second.
We haven't seen any data on that. So at this point, I wouldn't discourage anyone from going in to get it. Go ahead and get the booster now, even if you're past that 6 months. We were just saying in the past, you needed to wait at least 6 months. Going longer, we don't believe has any effect at this point.
When it comes to the Omicron variant spreading so fast, Tom, what is it that's causing such a spread? Is it just the way it's mutated?
Yeah, so it's doing what viruses like to do, which means mutate or adapt to their environment, right? I mean, we're trying to kill it. It's trying to kill us. As I've told my students, we adapt to the environment every year, right? And a couple of months ago, we were all wearing shorts and T-shirts, and now we're in long winter coats and hats and gloves. So we've adapted to our environment, and the virus is doing the same thing. So as it runs into our body's defenses, it mutates. And that's really an important message here, is that every infection, every time somebody gets infected, there is an opportunity for a mutation. Now, most of these mutations don't do anything or mean anything, but occasionally a mutation like Omicron becomes a new variant in a population, and we start all over again.
Well, when it comes to Omicron, Graham, are you concerned at all about how the state's healthcare system will be able to handle this surge?
Certainly, because, I mean, as we said, it's already stressed, and we had that kind of ongoing second leg of the Delta wave, which again, at last check, we're at 3,100 Hoosiers hospitalized. We're back to 100,000 Americans hospitalized. And, you know, we hit the 1 million confirmed cases, a world record globally for this pandemic yesterday. And if we hit 1 million confirmed cases, I think we could easily state that there's probably 2 million plus yesterday, just because we talked about the difficulties in getting a test. Maybe many, because it is, has this less intrinsic severity and other people have some immunity, maybe it's really mild for that individual. They don't get a test. I've had that with some personal family members and friends that have encouraged to be tested, and they were surprised they were positive. But again, back to that law of large numbers, because this has such a high reproductive rate and that one person can infect many, many others with this particular variant, that's just going to lead to that math problem we talked about and only foresee hospitalizations rising. I mean, we're just at the crest of the beginning of this wave. I think it will be very short, as we've kind of seen in Denmark, UK, and South Africa. But, you know, again, hospitals are lagging indicators. So I think, you know, what we're seeing now with 10, 12,000, 11,000 cases a day in Indiana, some percentage of that are going to be hospitalizations in maybe, 7 to 14 days. So very, very concerned. I've not felt this level of concern for the healthcare system, and, can't say enough about all the folks that are still continuing to show up and fight. And I think it's going to be a really challenging next several weeks for them. But I also think just generally we need to be prepared for disruptions this month and just be really flexible and nimble.
Yeah, I mean, I've been hearing a lot about the possible disruptions. I mean, definitely they've already started in many areas. I just wonder, it just seems like every time we hear these warnings or health experts like yourselves sounding the alarm, it takes like a month for the rest of the world to catch up, the rest of our society, I guess I should say. And so I don't know. I mean, how do you deal with that?
You cry, you wake up in a panic attack, you do deep breaths. But no, I think it's compounded right now, honestly. I think Shandy was saying earlier, maybe that this has, we think it has a quicker onset. It may be only 3 days before you're, showing symptoms and infectious, as opposed to maybe 4 to 5 with Delta or 5 to 7 with COVID Classic. And because of that higher reproductive rate, that gets compounded even faster. That's very problematic. And that's why continue to be on this mountaintop yelling about all these layers that we, need to implement and the easy ones that we need to implement. I think one of the biggest mistakes we've made, if you remember hot vaccine summer, like in late May, early June, very, very nice time during this pandemic. But we made the mistake. We put all these eggs into this vaccine basket, almost to the exclusion of all other things. And we thought that it was so effective that it could act as a single layer, when a lot of us in public health know that we need to stack those Swiss cheese slices up. And we still need to do that. And that's even more important today with what's going on with Omicron.
Shandy, do you think that with this variant, there could be new variants coming out now that even vaccinated folks are picking up COVID?
Yes. I mean, there's lots of opportunity. France came out, I believe, last night or this morning and said, yes, they've got another variant. And that's not unheard of. We assume we're going to see more and more variants. And that's another reason to go ahead and get people vaccinated as quickly as possible, because the more unvaccinated people we have, the more opportunities we have. And as we've seen, this virus has moved over to animals as well. So there's definitely a chance the virus could jump back and forth, animals to humans, mutate along the way. That's a concern. I can say the variation found in France right now, I think, was found around the same time as Omicron. It hasn't turned out to be a huge concern yet. It's not officially a variant of concern for WHO, but for whatever reason, the media picked that one up today. But there's constant surveillance going on around the world looking for other variations. We know we're going to see more, but again, that's more of a reason to go ahead and get vaccinated so we can slow this down. So we can, honestly, this is going to become endemic. We have to learn how to live with this, but right now we're not living with it. It's shutting things down and it's hurting the healthcare system and it's hurting those people who are going in the hospital for things other than COVID, as Graham and Tom were mentioning. So we have to get past this for this to become kind of our new norm.
Tom, is there anything around testing in Indiana that worries you right now?
So back when the pandemic began, testing was essential, right? I mean, we needed that testing to see, okay, who's infected, who needs to go in isolation, who needs to be quarantined. So that kind of helped us, or was an attempt to get our arms around this virus to prevent spread. As this pandemic wore on and on and on, we've seen trends in testing that have occurred. We saw a huge spike here recently with the holidays, and now we're seeing another spike again in testing with trying to get kids back in school and such. So the lack of testing or lack of availability testing is more based on demand at this point as opposed to supply. So it does worry me because people will say, I can't find a test anywhere, and I'm just going to go out and I'm going to go back to school, or I'm going to go back to work after being exposed without getting appropriately tested. And those things we know just continue to promote community spread.
The state said it's prioritizing young people for rapid testing to help prevent spread in Indiana schools. Graham, are you concerned about schools becoming a hotbed for the Omicron variant?
Yeah, I think so, especially those that do not have mask orders in place. And I just think that's just, again, the transmissibility. And there's some inequities across school districts and school systems. There's inequities in which they have philosophies or apply some of these layers. And so I think if a school district isn't considering better ventilation, good masking, good policies or test to stay policies, which, I mean, test to stay would require, you know, serial testing if you're exposed or those kind of things to stay in school. Well, we just said how, limiting the testing supply is. I honestly cannot believe we are 2 years into this and still don't have tests. I mean, the State Department of Health released that press release, I think we were alluding to earlier today, that they're now going to restrict rapid testing to just symptomatic folks 18 and over. And so that's problematic. And if the CDC is about to add a testing requirement for isolation, but nobody can get them, that seems kind of pointless at this point. So I know at the federal level, we're supposed to be ordering $500 million, and you're supposed to be able to sign up and get them mailed to you. I wish that would have occurred before the holidays, or honestly, a year and a half ago. But I do have some fear for the schools, just because, again, if you don't have teachers that are healthy and able to work, if you don't have cafeteria staff, if you don't have bus drivers, you're going to have some de facto disruptions. And the fact that, you know, a lot of schools are closing, maybe proactively or preventatively, I think is a shame, because these are the last things that should be closed, right? The fact that the bars are open, the schools are closing, is just another example of the failures we've had over the last 2 years in this country with this virus.
With schools closing in some districts, I wonder, are they just delaying the inevitable of a big rise when everybody comes back?
Not necessarily, because that rise is happening now. And I think it's just trying to get, because I really do think this will be a quick rise up, as we're seeing, and probably equally a quick rise down. And so I think that timing makes sense, you know, to maybe just take a pause there for a few weeks, just to kind of get through what would otherwise be a disruptive time and maybe a de facto shutdown as it is.
Shandy, what are your thoughts on how schools are handling this right now? Is everything being done that should be? Should they be more cautious?
So again, as Graham said, the critical piece here is masking. And so too many schools in Indiana stopped doing masking. They stopped contact tracing. They haven't been quarantining. And with Omicron being so much more contagious than the previous versions, I can see that being a huge problem with these students. So everyone got together over the holidays. They're coming back into class this week. We really need to make sure masking is always required in the classroom. We have seen last semester that in the schools that required masks on a regular basis and the students were good about making sure they were wearing their masks, we weren't seeing the outbreaks in those schools. Those schools that didn't have the mask requirement had a huge difference in absent students, teachers out, that sort of thing. So we've got to be diligent in making sure the schools are having the mask requirement at the school level. And honestly, that's all based on the leadership from what I've seen at the superintendent level. So if you got a strong superintendent and a strong principal, you can have a very strong response to COVID within the school setting.
Tom, early on in the pandemic, we heard a lot about herd immunity. Is that still a possibility in any way right now, or is this just a talking point that people like to throw out?
I think at this point, it's more of a talking point, to be perfectly honest. With the mutations that are occurring, I think we're going to have what we call an endemic situation where this virus is just going to be around, much like we see with influenza every year, where it just comes around, that we'll have some surges and some spikes. We'll get an annual booster, and we'll move on with our lives. To try and get to herd immunity, I don't know if, one, that was going to be possible, and two, I think we've kind of missed that boat, at least for now.
Graham, what would you say is the most important thing that needs to happen in Indiana right now to get us on the right track?
Empathy, respect for others, understanding that it's not about individual risks right now. It's about societal ones. And put on a first, wear a mask. To wear a better mask because it is an aerosolized virus. It is airborne virus and highly transmissible. And just think about the healthcare system and break the chain of transmission as much as you can. There's going to be a lot of transmission. Clearly there already is, but anything we can do to continue to break those chains and remember that, you know, no child under 5 has had the opportunity to be vaccinated. We have many people with high-risk conditions. We have very vulnerable people in our communities. We have immunocompromised people that even with vaccines, the vaccines may not work for them. Everybody's different, right? And so those are the people we need to protect. So do those layers, start with vaccination, then masking and so on around those people. But all of that can make a difference. And that's always the hardest thing in public health, right, is we are about prevention and proactive. You only hear about public health failures. You don't hear about successes because we don't, like, somebody taking a rapid test before their holiday gathering and staying home doesn't make the news, but maybe that broke some great length of transmission that could have led to severe disease or death for others. So really just having some empathy for others and understanding the collective and societal risks that we face the next several weeks.
Speaking of sort of things that make the news, I think every so often there's a repeated sort of story of someone who gets really, really sick and is like, now I believe it's a real virus and I want to get a vaccine. Shandy, how many stories are we going to have to hear before it really hits home?
Unfortunately, we're still hearing those stories as we do contact tracing. We hear people say, oh, if I'd known I'd gotten sick, I would have taken that vaccine. And I don't know where they've been living, but we've been trying to get the word out. And what I encourage people to do, too, is look at the faces that you're listening to on television, on the radio, the people who came out against the vaccine, those celebrities, some of the newscasters who came out against the vaccine, those are the people dying of COVID. The people who came out for the vaccine, promoting the vaccine, those are the people who have not died from COVID. They're still around. They're still on the radio. They're still on television. So really think about what camp you're listening to when it comes to making that decision about vaccination. Talk to your healthcare provider. If you've got concerns about fertility, lasting effects of the vaccine, whatever, please talk with your provider, because more than likely that provider can get you to understand that this is a safe vaccine and you need to take this for yourself and for your family and friends.
I want to thank Shandy Dearth, Tom Dzinski, and Graham McKean for joining us this afternoon. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.